VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There might not be any fans, but it's still the greatest annual rugby event in the world. The Six Nations starts on Saturday. England are the current holders, but can Eddie Jones's side hold on to their crown? Or will France, Wales, Ireland, or even the Scots make a tilt for the title? I'm Lawrence Dallaglio, and joining me today are Ruck regulars Owen Slot and Alex Lone. I'm delighted to say that we have a true rugby legend on the Ruck, former Lions and Wales Grand Slam winning captain, Sam Warburton. Gentlemen, good morning to everyone.
Hey, Lol. Great to have you on, Sam.
Thanks for having me on. No, great to be here.
You're a proper Times regular now. You've made it onto the Ruck as well.
I'm with the big boys now.
Well, come on, Owen. What you really meant to say is it's nice to have a proper rugby legend on the show, really.
Yeah, finally we've got one.
Gents, obviously it's a very exciting week. We're going ahead with the Six Nations, albeit in a slightly different environment. But before I start with that, Sam, lockdown. I mean, obviously I've chatted to you a few times. I guess it's quite busy in your household with your young kids running around.
Yeah, lockdown has been pretty relentless for us with obviously all the homeschooling and stuff like that. But I've actually quite enjoyed being at home and having the time with the little one. You know, so I can't complain. There's people in much, much worse situations. So it's been busy, but it's a nice busy, yeah.
Well, I'm sure you'd be looking forward to getting down to Cardiff.
Yeah, so even without fans, I just can't wait to get back in Principality again because it's been shut as it's been used as a hospital, you know, for the last best part of 12 months now, nearly. So even though we can go back there with no fans, it'd just be great just to be back at, you know, what is home of rugby back in Wales. That's with our opener against Ireland. So, yeah, can't wait for it to kick off and get stuck into that.
The Six Nations kicks off on Saturday with Italy against France at 2:15. And then, of course, the 150th anniversary of the Calcutta Cup, England against Scotland at 4:45. And then the next day, Sunday, Wales and Ireland make their entrance from Cardiff. And that kicks off at 3:00. Alex and Owen, you guys have been very close to England and Eddie Jones. I mean, they are the current champions. They've won, I think, 3 out of the last 5 titles, albeit on points difference last time around. I mean, the autumn internationals, the Nations Cup, as it were, gave us a different brand of rugby from what we're possibly used to. Eddie Jones tells us that, you know, all these styles are all about cycles, really. And at the moment, we're in a kicking cycle. But Alex, if I start with you, I mean, England are probably just about favourites given their form and the fact that they're the current champions, and maybe the fact that they've got 3 games at home. Do you see it that way?
I think that is probably what just tilts the balance towards them in terms of being favourites because they welcome France to Twickenham. France were there in the autumn, and England scraped an extra time win in the final of the Autumn Nations Cup. But it was, as we discussed at length on here, it was sort of second and third string players for France. They'll be back full tilt, minus the odd injured player, but losing Intermac, while on the surface it looks like a blow, Jalabert has been carving it up in the top 14, and I think he'll be just as dangerous. That looks like a pivotal fixture for me, France-England. I can understand why England would be marginal favourites, and it's one of those years where they'd benefit from having 3 home games, and the away games, which are often the most challenging, Wales away and Ireland away, this year don't look like being as treacherous as they have been in years gone by, just because of the respective situations that Wales and Ireland find themselves in.
Owen, do you think a lot rests and depends on how those Saracens players, the likes of Billy Vunipola, played once in about a couple of months, and Owen Farrell, Elliot Daly, Jamie George, none of them playing any rugby since before Christmas. Do you think a lot hinges on how they're able to sort of hit the ground running? They're saying that they've been training really hard, which I've no doubt they have, but it's not quite the same as playing week in, week out, is it?
Definitely, they have to come back in form. I think that there's a sort of sports science has taken match preparation to a level now where people can hit the ground running, to use that expression, far more ably than in the past, where kind of the acceptance was you needed 2 or 3 weeks to play. I mean, we've seen Mario Itoje and Mako Vunipola come back from injuries in the past and really hit a very high level quite quickly. I mean, there's a former Lions captain on this podcast who missed half of a Lions tour and then came straight back into a test match. So I think it can be done. Billy Vunipola is sort of the one that we question on that front, because there's always this sort of belief that he needs games. But Scottish fans won't thank me for saying this, but the fact is that England start with Scotland and then they have Ireland. And you have to say that if those Saracens players did need a game or two to get up to full speed, then the running orders come in the right way.
So I'm just now kind of rethinking my answer about England being slight favourites because they're playing France at home, which I can understand why that might be the case with the bookies. But Sam, when I'd be interested to know from, you know, what home advantage looks like without fans. I mean, you've obviously played in all these kind of enormous cauldrons with passionate fans, and that's often what we base home advantage on. Do you think it gets nullified?
I think so. Like Lawrence, you know, you'll remember when we were doing Europe in the knockout stages, you know, just gone by when lockdowns are over, and never has the away team won so much in a quarterfinal. And I don't think that was a coincidence, because there was no crowd. So I know there's the home advantage and away advantage still, because you have the sort of luxuries of being, for example, you know, in your regular team hotel the week build up, and you haven't got any travel, so you probably get an extra half a day's training. All these, you know, small things which can add up, but they're the small advantages of home advantage. But the main thing is obviously the crowd. So without the crowd, it would be interesting, because it happened in Europe where the away team has won more. I do expect to see probably a couple more away wins than normal, and it'd be fascinating to see Scotland as well, because they typically haven't travelled very well in Six Nations, and that's been their biggest downfall, and why, looking at line selections, why coaches haven't tended to go on with Scottish players, because they don't turn up when they go away from home, which is what a Lions tour is all about. So it'd be really interesting to see if that dynamic does affect the Scottish team, or whether they can travel better. So I don't expect home advantage to be as big a deal as it has been over the past years with no crowds.
Sam, what do you make of England? I mean, obviously they are the champions. They're the team that everyone wants to beat. They've got, you know, like all sides, a few issues coming into this championship in the sense there's one or two players injured, no Joe Launchbury, bit of a different look to them. But, you know, do you still see them as the team to beat, or is it neck and neck with France?
Yeah, I agree with Owen with, like, say that the 2 months, it would have been, well, I think December the 6th, you know, since a lot of those Saris boys have played. It's the same as a World Cup. So and they would have had a really tough, you know, sort of pre-season type of training. So when you go into a World Cup, you don't play for about 3 months, and then you go into an international, it's a friendly fixture, but it's still an international quality fixture, you know, when you have your warm-up games. So players are quite used to, and those guys have gone through a World Cup cycle, they're quite used to having a 2 month pre-season rolling straight into an international game, albeit it won't have the pressure of the Six Nations, a World Cup warm-up, but they can do that. And I think if it's a younger player, they would need games. But those guys now, they're some of the most experienced players out there, you know, in Europe and the world. So that they know what it takes to play international rugby. And I do think that the 2 months will be nice for them, and they'll come back, you know, okay. And like you say, the fixture list as well, I think it sort of does favour them slightly, no disrespect. No, they're not playing France, for example, first game up, in which case it might be an issue. But I expect England to win. Yeah, I mean, I just think England are playing. I know there was that Autumn Nations Cup game, and people look at how France came to England and second, third string, but there's a different dynamic when it's Six Nations. There's different pressure on it. You know, I think the French respond slightly differently to when there's a Six Nations game, when there's a lot of pressure on it. But I expect England, because they got France are close to it, but at the minute England have got unmatched physicality, which is what wins games more often than not these days.
Alex, as a man who's closer to the England camp than anyone in the written press, that's for sure. I mean, England have got some challenges. No Mako Vunipola at loose head. And it'd be interesting to see whether they go with Benno Urbano, I guess, or Ellis Genge. And the other interesting thing is, having only ever had two scrum halves in his squad ever, all of a sudden Eddie Jones has got three scrum halves. He's brought in Harry Randall. Mm. So I guess the key, you know, will the likes of Randall get a look in the championship? Who starts at loose head for you? And what's going to happen in the midfield? Because he's brought in Paolo Adogwu. Will he just go to the tried and tested sort of Farrell forward axis? Or is there going to be a bit more chance for others to shine?
I think that midfield combination is the key, really. Eddie, at the end of the autumn, eventually sort of conceded that for all the refereeing interpretations that he complained about on the slow ball, he did concede that England's attacking game had lacked cohesion. And I think, obviously, at the heart of that was he can't quite get the balance he wants in midfield when Manu Tuilagi's not around. And, you know, he tried Ollie Lawrence played, didn't do anything wrong, but the Farrell-Slade-Lawrence combination didn't quite spark. The Ford Farrell Slade combination didn't quite spark. And he's got Paolo Adogwu, who'd be a, you know, he talked up really highly, which is very unusual for Eddie to big up a player, because his usual approach is to try and keep them below the radar and keep them, you know, it's a team first thing. But he did praise him to the hilt. So I just wonder whether at some point the Six Nations will see a slight reshuffle and Adogwu get a chance. Yeah, front row, they're missing their three most senior props. Sinclair's banned for the first game against Scotland. Mako is injured and Joe Marler has declared himself unavailable. So I would expect them to start with Will Stewart and with Ellis Genge against Scotland, with Benno finally getting a chance on the bench. He's been in England squad for probably 2 years training with the team. And when he's not injured, he's always been there. So it feels like it's time for him to step up. They've got amazing depth in the front row, same in the back row. And with Harry Randall, I mean, everyone's screaming for him to play. I just wonder whether he's picked him to keep him out of Wales's clutches.
Can I just say, on the Benno Urbano front, there's a really outstanding interview with him in the Times today, where he talks about how the fact he was first in the squad 3 years ago. No, it's a really good interview, even though I do say it myself because I wrote it.
Very humble of you, Sam. As someone who seems to have a fantastic relationship with the referees, I'm fascinated to understand from your perception what you think the key interpretations will be, or what the things that are really going to be, you know, the watch outs for the players. I mean, obviously, I mentioned in the paper last week that the tackle height, I think, is going to be a really interesting one, that they're going to continue to stamp out the high tackles. You know, no player wants to necessarily go in there and hit someone in the head, but we're seeing a lot of tackles riding up, and I think there were, you know, we saw last campaign how discipline can cost a team in championships. I mean, do you see the breakdown and the tackle height being the big areas?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Tackle height, you know, when people say discipline, I mean, discipline covers all the aspects, but the main aspects of it is just the legality of your tackle height. And if I think that's the one thing that referees, and particularly in the Six Nations as well, where there's going to be an enormous audience watching who perhaps don't watch the rugby like we all watch it at club level, they're going to really want to protect the players, you know, going into this campaign where there's going to be, you know, 80-90% of viewers are going to be casual rugby fans, young people and players watching it. They're going to want to have a good image of rugby. So you can imagine they're all sat down, the coaches, and right, number one, we've got to really clamp out high tackles, head injuries, you know, anything, you know, even clear outs to the head, all these sorts of things, which we've seen being punished quite firmly. Well, I've seen it anyway in club games. You know, Liam Williams got red carded for a head collision in a ruck clear out. So with that, yeah, I definitely agree. I think if you want to get on the right side of a referee, you have got to be squeaky clean regarding your tackle heights, your ruck entries, and trying to avoid the head where possible. Obviously, it's rugby, it's sometimes unavoidable, but that's definitely going to be, I think, the biggest focus for referees and where you can get onside.
And Sam, Wayne Pivett had a really tough act to follow in Warren Gatland, because the Welsh public and a lot of other people in rugby fell in love with Gatland in terms of Wales, in terms of what he did with the Lions. I mean, they've won, what, 3 games out of 10 against Italy and Georgia. And listen, you were part of that coaching setup for a little while. I'm fascinated to know the reasons why you decided to step away. And, you know, what can we expect from Wales, sort of second Six Nations under Wayne?
Yeah, so I mean, I was chatting to Wayne when he was appointed coach, and he just said, oh, I wouldn't mind picking your brains on the setup, you know, what you thought of the previous regime, what you think could be done moving forward. I think quite deeply about the game, which I think people haven't really realised until I finish playing. I start talking about it. I actually, you know, I do quite...
We're sensitive souls. That's
You're not going to fit in round here, Sam, if you think about the game.
So I think people thought I literally just ran around like a headless chicken just trying to hit people. But I'm like, no, I actually used to study it a bit, you know. I told him everything I thought. And then I was called in for another meeting. He said, would you want to be part of the coaching staff? And I thought, I hadn't even done my level one. Like I did, I had no ambition to be a coach. But yeah, long story short, maybe I went back into coaching a little bit emotionally. And perhaps that was naively for myself because the opportunity to go back with the Welsh team was too good to turn down. But then I guess like when I was back in coaching, I realized I was only meant to be in on a campaign to campaign basis, but like I realized you can't do that. You know, if you're going to be a coach, you've got to be all in because you've got to be over all the players outside of camp, knowing what they're doing performances wise. And for me, it was too much of a commitment when I already had quite a lot going on anyway. And I said, if you're going to coach, you have got to be just a coach. You can't do a load of other things. And plus it was taking me right away from my family, which is kind of one of the reasons I finished playing in the first place. And I realized I'm straight back in the deep end here, away from home, going to be away from home a lot. And it was going to be worse with COVID bubbling up all the time. And I just had a newborn, all these things. I suddenly thought, you know what? I think this is my mistake. I've probably naively gone into coaching. And it wasn't for me, to be honest. I enjoyed some aspects of it. Other aspects of it I didn't enjoy too much. So I'm trying to condense that as much as I can.
Listen, you gave your life to international rugby and playing for Wales and playing. So it's no wonder you. I think we'll allow you a breather when you finally retired.
So Sam, just on that, did you not sort of scratch an itch at all with the coaching? It didn't make you feel a little bit like, or maybe when my life settled down a bit, I could give it a go? Or did you like have a taste of it and come to the other conclusion, actually, it's not what I want to do?
No, there's things I love. So like, you know, being pitch side, like I'm pitch side with Neil Jenkins. So, I mean, we got the H2O bibs on. I was literally getting people pulling me over. I was like putting petrol in a petrol pump once, and a guy pulled up next to me in Wales. You can't go anywhere anyway when there's a rugby game. He said, oh, congratulations on your new water boy appointment. I think you'll make a great water boy. I was like, yeah, thanks, man. I was like, yeah, that's literally all I'm paid to do.
He might have been one of those casual rugby observers that tunes in for the Six Nations.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it was brilliant to be back pitch side again, and like with Neil Jenkins, who's such a passionate Welshman. I was loving it, you know. Like I remember the Twickenham game was great, going back to England, and like you take some real, like I took some real pride in some of the things that, say, like from a small perspective, like say when we played England, we only got turned over once in that whole game in Twickenham, and like, because that's something which I was, you know, that was my area of the game. I was really proud of that. And I, you know, I would suddenly like go away from the game, even though I wouldn't talk to anyone about it. Like I was really pleased with how that went. So like you get those little wins as a coach, but as then like you weigh up the other options then of like say being away from home and things like that, it wasn't worth it then for me, if I'm being honest, as much as I love being part of the national team. Maybe I naively thought it would replace playing, but for me, you know, coaching doesn't replace playing for me. It does for some people, but yeah, it didn't for me.
Let's be honest, Pivot had a poor first 12 months. I mean, we can't dress it up any other way. There's obviously going to be a bit more pressure on him. Having Ireland at home and then Scotland away in the first two games, I think gives Wales as good a chance as they're likely to ever have to get off to a good start. You know, what are you expecting from them, and who are the key players from that Welsh squad? Obviously Alan Wynne as captain, and you know, there's that balance between some experience and trying to bring some younger players through.
No, you're right. Now is the time to deliver. And there is no excuses now. You know, teams have been together now for, even though there was the summer tour cancelled, you know, they would have had a good, can't think, maybe 10 games together. That's enough time. That's enough time now, you know. So yeah, now is the time definitely to deliver. But I do look, I'm thinking Wales literally have to win one of their first two games. Because if they don't, you know, they're going to France last game of the campaign with potentially only one win against Italy. So I'd be honest, you know, I'm a passionate Welshman. I'd love them to win. But if I got to be realistic about this, I can't see, and I'm sorry to say it to Welsh supporters, but I can't see us beating France or England. And Scotland and Ireland and Wales, I think we're all kind of, well, Ireland convincingly beat us in the autumn series, and so did Scotland. So Wales aren't in a great place right now, if you're looking at it on paper. And the thing is with Wales, I think we've always had, and I do worry whether 2019 was the last of the recent era. We've always had X-factor players who can bail us out. So, I mean, Toby Faletau and Justin Tipperick were outstanding in our last game against Italy. But you look at all the British Lions that we've got, they haven't hit the heights that they've hit previously in the past 4 or 5 years or in their career. And we've got a couple of young guys coming through who I think could be like Lions bolters. They've got that potential. But the experience of the team, so when you look at the experienced players in England, they'll rock up and they play for England. The experience that we've got and the spine of the team that we've had haven't been playing as well as they have been. They haven't been having those X-factor moments, and you need those X-factor players. So, you know, for Wales, it's either going to be, are the youngsters going to significantly step up and become the new breed and the new iconic era of Welsh players? Or are the Lions boys going to recapture some form, and that's going to help catapult us a bit as well? So one of those two things has to happen for Wales to win more than two games, I think.
Owen, I'd like to just talk to you about France because, you know, it's important that they're building and building and building. You interviewed Ibanez recently, and I know you enjoyed that very much. They've obviously got Fabien Galthié and Sean Edwards, who Sam knows and we all know a huge amount about. I mean, can they build on that form in the autumn? I mean, they've got Italy in the first game, then they get their real first test against Ireland, I guess, in Dublin. What do you see from France, having chatted to their manager Ibanez recently?
Yeah, I think they will build. Ibanez was so passionate about it, and I thought it was really interesting that he said, "Where am I talking to you? Are you at the training ground camp in Marcoussis outside Paris?" And he said, "No, we've gone down to Nice again." And he said, "The reason we went down to Nice is because this project, which he calls Fabien Galthié Ibanez New Era thing, they call it their project. They started in Nice in January last year. They took all this sort of extraordinarily new young generation of players down to Nice, and they did their fortnight's preparation down there. And he said, that's where it all began. That's where it all began. He said, so we decided we've got to go back there again to remind them that this was where the project began, and now we're going to take them on one step further. And you know, they did outperform all expectations in the last Six Nations, and now we there are expectations upon them. But you've got to remember that they are such a young team that they're theoretically on that improvement curve that's still going up quite steeply. Everyone knows what's going to be coming at them now. But when you've got Dupont at your number nine, that doesn't often really help you. But I expect more and better from them. As Alex said, they're missing Entomac, but the backup crew's not bad either.
No, they are. They're very good. I mean, Alex, it's hard to believe that they haven't won a Six Nations title for 11 years. That must irritate them and irk them somewhat. As Owen said, no Entomac, no Demba Ba. Demba Ba, he's a football player. No Bamba and no Woki. I mean, they're still in good shape, right? I mean, they've got some amazing talent. At club level, they seem to be producing, you know, big, big performances with the likes of Toulon going well, Toulouse going well, Bordeaux. So you see them as a real threat. Do you think that game against England in March is the pivotal game?
Yeah, I definitely see it building up towards that weekend. I think, obviously, Dupont and Entomac and that back line took all the plaudits, really, in last year's Six Nations. But I just think you look at the rock upon which, you know, they're able to operate, and players like Charles Olivant and Greg Aldrit are just, they seem to have taken helped take French forward play to another level, and they were outstanding. And in any other year, either of them could have been Six Nations player of the tournament. I thought both of them in that back row were. And in terms of, 11 years since they won the title, they must look at that Scotland game and rue that punch, which really cost them that game. They lost their heads a bit that day, and maybe a coach as wily as Eddie Jones will be looking at that and will realise that, a young team, passionate but potentially volatile, could they get under their skin? That could be a route to defeating them. But I think they're a year older, they're a year more mature, but they don't just have the stardust out wide. They've got a real rock-solid pack and with some highly impressive players there. So, yeah, they'll be dangerous.
I think that's really interesting about can we get under their skin. I think that's one of the hallmarks of this new team is that they're not that – they don't seem to come with the stereotypes of the French teams of the previous decade and a half, if you like, where they might just fall apart when it gets too hot, or they might be a bit flaky in the wrong situations. This is the new crew, and one, they've got Sean Edwards, who is thumping chipping away on the discipline, and two, they seem to have that sort of a different kind of self-belief about them.
I still think there's always room for improvement, but I still think that from a S&C, from a fitness perspective, I think certainly in the tight five, the way that I watch top 14 rugby is just ever so slightly different. I still think they've got a little way to go if they want to, you know, get their tight five forwards in the game, you know, particularly in the last 20, 30 minutes when games are won and lost. But on the back of what we saw against England in Paris last year, where they absolutely battered England, I mean, do you see them being a real threat?
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think Sean Edwards being added to that group, I think, you know, they never really looked at coaches outside of their like bubble, their French bubble. And I've seen Sean Edwards speak to a Welsh, I can't say his name, a Welsh front row player. And he said, if you sort your diet out, and you're not so lazy, you could be a British Lion. And I'm pretty sure he'd be saying that across the French team. He won't mind ruffling a few feathers. And that's what I think France have needed. He will say, you're not fit enough to beat England, you know, when he first went in. You're not fit enough to beat Ireland. You're not fit enough to beat Wales consistently. And that's been proven over the past 10 years. I think they've needed him. So say, like, you look at the semi-final, or was it the quarterfinal of the World Cup, where was it Vahamina elbowed, you know, right? The Welsh, I think it was Aaron Wainwright. And that basically cost France the game. Like, if that happened under Sean's regime while he was coaching, honestly, I would have loved to have been that team meeting on the Monday. And Lawrence, you probably remember those. You will call him out and make sure that no French player ever wants to do that ever again. And their discipline has been gradually improving, because that's such a massive part of the game these days regarding territory possession stuff. So I do think that their discipline will get much better. And you could look at the fact that when they're playing England, it's the fourth weekend. For France, that's perfect, because if they were playing England first weekend up, England, I think, would be pretty hot favourites, because France coming back together, England are well knit. You know, they're going to have three reviews, you know, three previews and three games to learn from by the time they get to England. So Sean's defensive system, obviously, it'll take a game or two for them to get it all back in sync again. And they got Italy up first. That's a good game. They can get away with making a few mistakes. I remember Wales, when I was coaching them, we played Italy first up. We beat them by about 40 points, you know, last season, just gone. But we had some howling defensive errors. But we got away with it because it's Italy, no disrespect, and we might come on to that later. But so they can get away with that against Italy, but by the time they come to play England, those tools will be sharpened. So it's going to be a straight shootout, I think, between England and France. But the fact they've got Sean then to nurture them again for another 5 weeks before they play England will make that game even more tasty.
Yeah, I do remember Sean Edwards and Rafael Ibanez coming together when Raf came to play for Wasps, and we had a rather poor performance against the Scarlets. And in the debrief on the Monday morning, you know, Sean Edwards, as you say, Sam, no, didn't worry about anyone's reputation. He was absolutely climbing into Ibanez. And Ibanez came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I couldn't understand Sean's accent. He's from Wigan. What was he saying? I said to him, you know, I know him perfectly well that he could understand what he was saying. I said he was saying that basically he thought we'd signed Rafael Ibanez, the captain of France, 99 caps, but it appears that we've signed an imposter. And anyway, suffice to say, we played the Scarlets again the following week, and poor old Matthew Rees was stretched off after 20 minutes. So I do see France as being, you know, being a very tough nut to crack. And I think they're going to get better and better. Enjoy more rugby insight and analysis throughout the season with the Times and the Sunday Times. Get a subscription today and get 1 month free. Search thetimes.co.uk/theruck for more details.
The train is now approaching junction.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Gents, before we bring in Peter O'Reilly and Mark Palmer to talk Scotland and Ireland. I'm keen to get everyone's perspective. I think I know the answer to this, but on Italy, just very quickly, Alex, there is improvement in the Italian setup, but is it enough for them to get that all-important win in the championship? Bear in mind, they play France in the first fixture, and then they go to Twickenham to play England in the second. It's like having a 2 and a 3 in poker, really, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah, I'm just looking at their list here. I don't think they'll expect to get much from the first two games. Where are they after that? Home to Ireland, home to Wales, and then away to Scotland. And it's always that. You know, they've done all right at Murrayfield in years gone by, but we say it all the time, every year with Italy. There are always sort of shoots of optimism. You know, at the moment, you're looking at a player like Jake Pelledri, who would get into pretty much any of the Six Nations teams. You know, he's such a good player.
But he's injured.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. he can't even get in the Gloucester team, Alex.
All right, well, I can't see any shoots for optimism at all. They couldn't even sign Paolo Adogru, so no.
I feel quite strongly about Italy. I think enough's enough. Like, I think we've been clutching on to players and the odd performance. Like, they're simply not good enough. They're simply not good enough. They haven't got the player pool. They've had some great coaches go over there and try and do some work. I'm not saying that the teams in the next tier of Europe are good enough either. They're not. There's a massive gulf between the top five teams and everyone else. But I think something's got to happen in the sense of, it probably won't happen, but it's even in the Pro 14, I think. Like, I think the Italian team should play in the French league. Logistically, it's much better for them. I think you should keep the Pro 14 like the Celtic league, like it was before. It's all getting too much of a mishmash. I think then they can have, logistically, they'll have better travel playing in France. They can earn their right into Europe that way. But I think you've got to have promotion relegation. I know it won't happen, but then that's another conversation. But if you're going to constantly put a glass ceiling on these teams beneath them, then we're never going to get improvement. You're never. And I just think with Italy, I'd be pretty safe to say, this could come back to bite me in the backside, but they're going to lose 5 games. And I just can't see, I just haven't seen any development whatsoever. And we hold on to the odd game, but if we're being realistic, they're not going to compete. And I can't see it for the future.
Well, I think here, Sam, I mean, it's as someone who's half Italian, it's even more painful for me to say it, but I just think the fixture list, particularly this year, is just so brutal for them. You know, momentum is everything. Belief is everything. Injuries and strength and depth is everything. And I think if you've got your away to, or you've got home against France, who are a very different France side, and then England and then Ireland, I mean, they could have half a squad left by the time they play, the other games. Owen?
So, yeah, Sam, just love to know what you think should happen. It's hard to disagree with you that Italy aren't up to scratch, but would you have a Five Nations, or would you just have a promotion relegation from the tier below, which doesn't really exist properly yet?
Yeah, I think we should have a promotion relegation. I think whoever comes bottom of the Six Nations should have a home fixture in the next international window against whoever won the Tier 2 European competition. And if the winner of the Tier 2 competition, say, for example, if it's Georgia and Italy in this case, if they can go to Italy and beat Italy on their home ground, then they should go up into the Six Nations. So it doesn't give you, you know, just because you get relegated doesn't mean you're definitely going to be gone. I still think they deserve a playoff game to give them a chance to stay up, just to make sure that the team coming up isn't miles away. But I would love to happen. I'm pretty sure if it was Italy playing Georgia for a Six Nations sort of qualifier, whether that was in the summer or whether it was the first week of the autumn, whatever, I'm pretty sure that would get pretty good viewing figures. You know, we'd all be fascinated to see how that would go.
I love that idea. And as you can tell from my answer, we are clutching at straws for positives around Italy. I think that's a great idea. It would generate interest. It would generate the competitiveness. It would give Georgia and the second tier a chance, you know, a chance to get up. I just think there's so many hurdles between it being a good idea and it actually happening. Because
I'll give you a few positives. Rome, Barolo, Brunello, red wine. The best post-match reception I've ever been to in my life. And not a bad night out either, quite frankly. So we can forgive them for all the missed tackles, all the inability to scrummage. In my mind, we're not taking Rome off the menu, all right? And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Peter O'Reilly and Mark Palmer to bring some real rugby, apart from Sam Warburton, of course, to bring some real rugby analysis and insight to this podcast at long last, some long overdue. Peter, if I start with you first, you won't have heard necessarily what we were chatting about previously, but you wouldn't be unsurprised to say that England and France sort of start the tournament as joint favourites. No one thinks Italy are going to win a game, but Rome's such a good place to go that they have to stay in the Six Nations. And hopefully we'll see a bit of improvement from Wales, but the first game against Ireland is the key. It's not exactly been a straightforward 12 months or 24 months for Andy Farrell either, but Ireland, you feel like there's something building there. They've unearthed one or two new players. I think they're a team with a point to prove, in my mind anyway. Their forward pack's been smashed on a couple of occasions against England, and I just feel that they've got a point to prove. I think Ireland could be a real handful this campaign.
We don't know. That's the whole thing about Ireland. There's a sense that they've been treading water a little bit since the last World Cup, and that a fairly inexperienced coaching team is still heading in. So it's hard to read the results from 2020. 9 games played, 6 wins, which were basically home wins, over 2 wins over Wales at home, 2 wins over Scotland at home. But against England and France on the road, Ireland, you know, were smashed, as you said, physically, especially up front. So nobody's exactly sure what to make of the Andy Farrell era yet. There are reasons for some, two main reasons. Well, first of all, on Saturday night, Tadhg Furlong put in a 40-minute shift. Now, that's second string in the Pro 14, isn't exactly the Six Nations, but looked trim, he looked sharp, and he'll definitely come into the 23. Can't see him starting against Wales, but he's an energy giver, he's a carrier, he's a scrummager, he's a leader, all that sort of thing. So that's one reason to feel positive. The second thing is Paul O'Connell is involved as forwards coach now. When he was a player, we used to attribute him superhuman qualities. It's a bit unfair to be giving him those qualities as a coach, given that his professional coaching experience is so limited. But all of the players, I think, who are there at the moment, seen him as a bit of a hero when they were younger. And he's going to bring energy as well. And hopefully he will sort out the line out. Because it's very hard to read Ireland's attacking game based on 2020 form, because they weren't getting the sort of ball that they needed. So it starts with sorting out those Furlong's return and O'Connell's arrival are reasons to feel optimistic.
Yeah, Peter, I just want to push you on some of the players as well. I mean, obviously Furlong back, Sexton and Conor Murray still with points to prove, even though you know, people are saying, are they past their best? But with Sam here and myself here, obviously we cast an eye on the back row. I really like Caelan Doris. I think he's the real deal. I think he's a super, super player. And I think this might be the tournament where people know much more about him, you know, and he makes a real impression. Am I a bit premature there, or do you think he could be one of the stars of the show?
Yeah, no, he's been very impressive. He isn't the biggest number 8, you know, and he doesn't look particularly explosive, but he seems to be made of rubber. He's got really good feet, so he tends to slide out of tackles, you know. So he gives something a little bit different. As we know from watching CJ over the last few years, he tends to be straight line runner, doesn't tend to be an offloader, whereas Doris seems to be a little bit more of a footballer, might put people over. So he offers something a bit different. They have Henderson in the second row and they have Furlong back. You know, they have carriers in front row, second row and back row. And then if they can give some front football, they have some reasonably kind of exciting attackers in the back line as well, with Larmour coming back, Ringrose coming back. James Lowe is yet to prove himself at international level. Didn't look up to it at Twickenham. But for Leinster, when he gets front football, he can be devastating. Mike Catt has been given a bit of a pass as attack coach because the back line hasn't been given any quick front football. But if they can manage to do that, then it might be a bit more of a handful as an attacking force.
Mark, I'm going to come on to you yourself and Scotland. Obviously, Finn Russell is returned, all is well, very peaceful return back to the squad. He seems to have settled back in and, you know, seems to have got the right reaction from his teammates. Do you think Scotland can be genuine contenders this year? I mean, they've got the best fixture they could ever possibly hope to start with. I mean, albeit it's at Twickenham, but the 150th anniversary of the Calcutta Cup, I guess a lot would depend on them getting off to a fast start against England.
That's right, Lawrence. I mean, the traditionally very slow starters in this tournament in Scotland, and there's no margin for that to happen this year with England, as you say, first up, and then Wales at home. I think, as you said, Finn's return is huge. Last year, he was only on the park for half an hour for Scotland in the whole of 2020 for various reasons, as we know. But there was, the team having been built purely on kind of X Factor and pizzazz before that, lacked that massively last year. The balance went all the way back to, the fundamentals improved significantly around set, scrum, breakdown, defence, but all the things that kind of we come to expect from Gregor's Scotland team were missing in terms of, what they do in attack. Finn's obviously a massive part of that, but you'd also be hoping for some more assistance from the other boys in midfield as well, which is where I think the arrival of Cameron Redpath is a huge boost, potentially. He seems to be very much on the same wavelength as Russell, and having that sort of second distributor there will hopefully help them bring the back three into play. You've got some great guys there in Hogg, Van der Merwe and Darcy Graham, but they weren't particularly well serviced last year, or certainly consistently, and the hope that having an extra pair of fans in there for Finn and an extra pair of eyes as well will hopefully take some of that burden.
Sam, what do you make of Finn Russell? I mean, obviously if everyone was picking a Lions team, he'd certainly be part of that conversation. There's obviously that kind of whole risk reward kind of ratio with him. I was saying yesterday on the telly that I'd like his highlights reel, but I'd like Owen Farrell's trophy cabinet, really. I mean, he's what I'm saying is Finn Russell does things that no other player can do, but does he do enough to win games?
Yeah, when you talk about Lions, I guess it all depends on the coach. If you're looking at the coach this year, who's Warren, he's going to want quite a pragmatic 10. You know, he's not going to want a 10 who he's going to be calling in at the end of the games. He's going to chip and chase in his own 22 when they're like leading by 2 points. Like, that's not the 10 he wants. That's why probably it's taken players like, say, like for a Welsh perspective, no, Warren's not coach now, but say like Callum Sheedy, why it's taken him longer than probably people expected, because it's taken about 3 injuries to Wales fly halves for Callum Sheedy to get a chance, because at international level, you need someone to steer the ship, you know, and that's where I know people love to see flamboyant open rugby. But at test match level, what wins rugby is a very astute kicking game, very good understanding, composure. You know, that's what you need from your number 10, and to be defensively quite strong as well, because you look across all the home nations now, you've got like Johnny Williams for Wales, you've got Bundiaki, Henshaw, you've got these guys who are going to be flying into number 10s. We've sat in enough team meetings where you say, right, we're going at number 10. Finn Russell doesn't give opposition attacks too much choice, and that they do tend to think, well, he's probably 13, 14 stone. We'll send a 16, 17 stone powerhouse down his channel wherever he can. So there's all these sorts of game you've got to shore up. Don't get me wrong, there's a talent. I think he's one of the best, most gifted handlers of the ball that we've probably seen, in many years. A phenomenal player and talent. If he suddenly turns up and he's got a really good kicking game and really good balance to his play, then yeah, definitely, Lions contender. But I think when you come to Six Nations, it's very different to playing for RAS in 92.
Mark, give us one or two players from Scotland's team that we should be looking out for, our listeners should be looking out for.
The form of the two pro teams has not been good at all this year, but loads of things have gone into it around injuries and, big blocks of unavailability with COVID and test commitments. But, guys like Van der Merwe on the wing, who made a great impression in the autumn in his first kind of availability, he his strike rate in the Pro 14 and Champions Cup speaks for itself in the last number of years. As I said, Redpath, I think, is a really big addition in a number of ways in terms of how they want to play the game. I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing a bit more of Gary Graham in the back row as well. He's only had a couple of caps off the bench so far, but Scotland have long been crying out for that kind of ball-carrying number 8. We've got two excellent flankers in Ritchie and Watson, but nobody's really nailed that jersey between them. But I think he has the sort of abrasiveness and the energy and the all-round game to do that. So looking forward to seeing a bit more of him too.
Peter, on before I come to Owen and Alex on Ireland and Scotland as well, from your perspective, obviously they won three Ireland out of five under Andy Farrell last season, losing obviously to the two teams above them. But I mean, what constitutes success for you? I mean, you seem to think, and many people say, well, we're not quite sure what we're going to get from Ireland. I think they're going to surprise a few people really this season if they keep everyone fit. But what do the Irish public want from Andy Farrell's team?
The Irish public has got used to a level of success which certainly wasn't around when I was growing up. It's 2013 is the last time that Ireland finished in the bottom half of the Six Nations. Since then, they've had a Grand Slam and two titles. That's, you know, three titles under Joe Schmidt. So levels of expectation are pretty high now. So if Ireland weren't to finish in the top half, questions would be asked about whether Andy Farrell is the guy that should be taking them towards the next World Cup. If they finished third, that mezzanine level just below England and France, I think that will be acceptable. And if they produce performances against France and England, if they play a bit of rugby against France and England, again, that will give reasons for hope. If they were to pick England or France off, like say France, second round, coming to Dublin, none of that French team have ever won in Dublin. Not that I know home advantage is diluted now, but say they were to pick France off in that game, and maybe at 4 out of 5, then you're talking about they've turned a corner and there's a renewed optimism. So I think third is acceptable. Anything in the bottom half, then we're, you know, all bets are off. We're asking questions.
Alex and Owen, just a quick word on Scotland and Ireland respectively for you. Alex, go with Scotland against England. I mean, I guess, you know, if they get off to that good start, then it could be an interesting campaign.
Yes, I mean, if they get off to that good start. What I found interesting listening to those guys, when Peter was talking about Ireland and, you know, the mezzanine level, and if they finish third, they start against Wales, and that's pretty much what Sam was saying at the start of this conversation, that, you know, that first game, Wales-Ireland, is huge in terms of where those two teams could go in the remainder of the championship. And I think you start with England, Scotland and Wales, Ireland, the tournament gets off to a rapid start. But for Wales and Ireland, it could shape the rest of the championship.
And Owen, I guess the question I probably should have asked Peter was, why can't Ireland play like Leinster? And will Mike Catt get more out of this Ireland back line than possibly we've seen in the last couple of years?
Their problem since Farrell's taken over is their forwards haven't dominated and provided the kind of ball that they need. I mean, that's what Pete was saying. That's why Mike Catt sort of had a bit of a free pass yet, and people haven't been able to really assess his contribution because he hasn't had much ball to play with. I think that whole Ireland project has really sort of been becalmed in their first year. And I'm sure they know that, but they have this problem facing Andy Farrell is he hasn't been able to move on the halfbacks into the next generation, and that's largely because he can't identify who the next generation is.
Well, the other slightly controversial question, which is probably not for this pod, but the second best fly half in Ireland is Paddy Jackson, without a shadow of a doubt, and you know, for lots of reasons, he you know, one, playing outside of Ireland, and secondly because, you know, of his previous court case, he probably won't get picked for Ireland. But if anyone who saw him play yesterday and has been watching him all season, you've got to say that he's a worthy understudy to the likes of Sexton and possibly Billy Burns.
That's a really interesting point because they've been waiting for Joey Carberry to come back from injury, and he seems to be just permanently mired there. They can't find someone good enough to step up. And as you say, Lawrence, Paddy Jackson's been playing really, really well, and he's got plenty of caps from his pre-court case era. There is an answer there, but as you say, no one wants it.
I want to go to the quick fire round, and I'm not going to necessarily put anyone under pressure to say where they think their own country might finish in the tournament. Although you can if you want, but quick fire round, really, just to all of you. I'll start with you, Sam. Winners of the tournament overall, and will there be a Grand Slam?
Oh God, that's a good one. I mean, maybe quick fire. That's tough. It's between England and France. So I think. Grand Slam. There's always an upset, see? I don't think there'll be a Grand Slam because they've been upset, but I expect England to win.
Owen?
Yeah, I think England win, and I think they do a Grand Slam. Am I allowed one more sentence? I just think that they won in the autumn, and there's so much more to give from there. They can go up a level easy.
Arthur?
Yeah, I think I think predicting a Grand Slam is notoriously dangerous, but the way the fixtures are, and if I'm picking England to beat France at home, then I'm picking England to do the Grand Slam as well.
I still think that the fixture England-France is pivotal. I think whoever wins that wins the tournament, but I don't think that there will be a Grand Slam because I think, bar Italy, I think every team in this tournament's got one big performance in them. And I think that one, you know, that'll mean that there won't be a Grand Slam. If England beat France, I could see them being beaten by one of the others as well, possibly Ireland in Dublin, which I think is if I'm an Irish forward now, I can't wait for that game because yeah. I've been absolutely battered by England probably last two or three fixtures, and they owe England big time. And I think that one could be the one where England slip up. But a lot to happen before then. Sam, players to look out for, and cast the net as wide as you like.
So to start outside of Wales, I really think Van der Merwe is one for Scotland. He's somebody who could be, well, I say dark horse now, perhaps not so much in 2 months' time, but dark horse for the British Lions. Really like his power. I just think he's just a real good modern-day winger. From a Welsh perspective, from a Welsh hat on, I said it before, but I think Johnny Williams is a dark horse at 12. I think Johnny Williams has been looking really good for Wales. I was gutted when he had to pull out with injury at the end of the Autumn Nations Cup. I was really looking forward to seeing how he's going to go. But I've just seen him grow and grow in that 12 shirt. So he's got, and then Thomas Williams at 9, he's back fit for Wales. I think he's also a contender looking ahead to the summer. He's a Lions quality player as well. So from Wales' perspective, yeah, I'd look out for Johnny Williams and Thomas Williams.
Alex, from you, any players across the teams that you've got your eye on? I'm really excited to see.
I had Van der Merwe too written down. I haven't seen as much Pro 14 rugby as Sam would have done, but I've seen what he's done in European games, and obviously he made a big start in the autumn. And obviously everything now is, we look at through a Lions prism, and Van der Merwe does look to me like the kind of player that Warren Gatland would want to take into a series against the Springboks. From an England perspective, Eddie rotates his squad a little bit each time. He's brought in, as we said earlier, Adogru and Randall. I'd be excited to see both. Just don't know whether we'll get to see much of either. And so it comes down to Ellis Genge. And I look forward to seeing Ellis as England's first choice loose head at the moment. People still have doubts about his scrummaging ability, and I would back him to prove those doubters wrong. I'm excited by what he could do.
Yeah, three players. Really want to see what Cameron Redpath does for Scotland if he's given the chance. Is he the player that England are going to be going, we should have just made more effort on that front? He could have been played for England. I really want to see Matthew Jalibert filling in for Entomac for France. Entomac was brilliant, but Jalibert was the sort of the golden boy before Entomac, had come through into senior level. So Jalibert will be interesting. And for England, Sam Underhill unavailable. Does that make Ben Earl a first choice for the back row? Possibly. There is a kid who is absolutely desperate to show how good he is, and I think he's very good indeed.
Well, just from my point of view, for the star value, Mario Toji, I love watching him play. If he can carry on that rich vein of form, I think for France, often when players get awards, we tend to sort of overlook them really. But Anton Dupont is just gold. He's absolute gold, and I agree with you, Jalibert, and also Damien Penaud as well. I have to say, I love watching him play. He's sort of wiry, but just so skillful. So really looking forward to seeing him play. And I think I mentioned him earlier on, Caelan Doris. I think he's a really good number eight, and I think he could be the best number eight in the tournament.
I can't wait to see Jake Pelledri.
Well, you'll see Jake Pelledri because he'll be sat a couple of seats away from you watching the game, Alex. Well, there you have it. All of our ruck experts have spoken, which means that all of it is irrelevant and nothing like that will happen. But I'm sure all of you are looking forward to the Six Nations kicking off with Italy against France, 2:15 on Saturday. My thanks to Sam Warburton, Alex Lowe, Owen Slott, as well as Mark Palmer and Peter O'Reilly. The Ruck will be back next Monday when we'll know who are the winners and the losers on the opening weekend of the Six Nations. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.